KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Ashley Jeffcoat.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Hope you had an enjoyable 4th of July. If you had to endure a bad rendition of the Star Spangled Banner...
First of all, our condolences.
Yeah, our national anthem is not the easiest song to sing. So, of course, someone has tried to do something about that. We'll tell you about it.
And we'll also tell you about a future scenario along the Colorado River that's pretty scary for water managers to imagine.
It's never happened, and we don't want to see it happen because the chaos would cause economic uncertainty throughout the state.
It sounds like the stuff of dystopian fiction. It's called the Compact Call, and we'll explain what that is coming up in 15 minutes.
Rural school districts in Colorado are having a hard time finding enough educators to fill open positions.
We ended up with having no applicants and really having to get creative in that realm and start to look overseas.
We'll hear what some schools on the Eastern Plains are doing to address the teacher shortage.
And KUNC critic Howie Mofshevitz reviews a movie.
But first, foster parents opened their homes and hearts to children in need. But there's a shortage of them in Colorado, about 1,200, according to a new estimate. Lawmakers addressed the issue during this year's legislative session, but as KUNC's Benta Berkland reports, the reasons behind the decline are not totally clear.
Ann and Mario Perricone live in Denver. The couple have two teenage daughters of their own, and for the last 11 years, they've been foster parents. Right now, they have a 19-year-old high school girl living with them, along with her two children, ages 5 and 1.
I know. What's out there? What's out there?
A 20-year-old boy they started fostering when he was 16 also lives in the home. Even though they never adopted him, they consider him a son and a permanent member of the family.
The attachment automatically happens.
Over the years, the Perricones have taken in more than 50 children, all with the support of their daughters.
It's been a pretty amazing experience.
But that doesn't mean things always work out. The Perricones have had 4 children that have had to be placed elsewhere after first coming to their house. One was a serious neglect case.
She was almost 3 years old when she came, and within the first few days, she would smear feces on every surface that she could touch, and that was beyond my wheel well
of
training that I'd been through. That was just something that was really difficult for me.
When they don't know those things, that's when foster parents burn out, and kids in foster care end up in group homes instead of forever homes.
That's Democratic Representative Jonathan Singer of Longmont. He sponsored legislation last session that now lets foster parents access a child's medical and education records before they take the child in.
You can start to prepare yourself and better take care of that kid so they can get the care that they need.
In Colorado, there's no statewide system for foster care placement. It's handled by individual counties. Reggie Bika is the head of the Colorado Department of Human Services. He says this has led to different standards.
The statutes in Colorado were not very clear about what information foster parents can get for children in their care. And depending upon which county they were in, their attorneys might suggest that foster parents weren't entitled to medical records or educational records or social service records.
The new law also prioritizes paying foster parents the full cost of childcare under a federal program that gives money to low-income families.
What we've done is made it more clear that they need to be a priority population and that everywhere in the state, if a foster child needs to be in a licensed child care setting, this child care assistance should be available in addition to the foster care stipend that the parents are already receiving.
And a separate bill will now compensate foster parents for transporting children to the same school they were already attending. All of this still doesn't address why foster parents stop doing the work or why not enough people want to. It doesn't help that counties don't always collect that information. Mimi Sherman is the director of Child Welfare and Adult Protective Services in Denver.
We do have times where we cannot find foster care placement for children and we have to look at higher levels of care. But that doesn't always mean that we don't have enough foster homes. It may mean that we don't have the right foster home for the kid in need of placement. And we don't have the data to distinguish between those situations.
Other counties like Mesa on the Western Slope track the shortage. Mesa County says 40 teenagers were placed outside of the county because of a shortage of foster homes, so they're now recruiting more people. Right now, the state and counties don't talk to parents directly if they decide to stop fostering children. Anne and Mario Perricone think more can be done, like creating a mentoring or retention team, and at the very least, conducting exit interviews.
If it's not working out for these foster families, what can be done? They leave, but there isn't a conversation about what could we have done to help make this job easier for you.
2017 was the first year that the Colorado Department of Human Services tried to track the shortage of foster parents. Reggie Beekes says child placement agencies and counties already have diligent recruitment plans, and the state will continue to track that data.
We want to make certain that we're getting kids into the right homes and families getting the right kids.
That was Binta Berkland. Now, at KUNC, I'm not just your occasional Colorado Edition host. I also handle all of our social media. One of the stories that's gotten a lot of feedback in the last week is that of Colorado woman Shauna Johnson. She left a message in chalk outside Representative Ken Buck's Castle Rock office. It said, "Stop putting kids in cages."
Now, that's referring to the Trump administration's policy of detaining people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, separating children from their parents.
Right, and that policy has since been dropped.
Now, after she left the message, the building manager, not a member of Buck's staff, contacted law enforcement about it. A few hours later, Johnson was issued a citation for second-degree criminal tampering that could result in up to a $1,000 fine or a year in jail.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado had decided to take on her case. Mark Silverstein said the charges were excessive.
The state would have to show that she tampered with property with the intent to cause injury, inconvenience, or annoyance. And I think it's very clear that she didn't do anything for the purpose of causing injury, inconvenience, or annoyance. She wrote with chalk to communicate a message to her congressperson.
This week, the attorney for the 12th District filed a motion to have those charges dismissed. In a statement, the ACLU of Colorado said they were pleased with the result.
Colorado business owners are losing confidence in the nation's economy. That's according to results of a quarterly survey from CU Boulder's Lead School of Business. KUNC's Matt Bloom explains.
Two of the biggest concerns for business owners heading into the second half of the year are labor and the affordability and availability of housing. Rich Wabekind is with the Lead School. He says immigration and trade are also factors.
So they do continue to have those concerns. And of course, we have those concerns from our observations that that's one of the things that could ultimately slow the growth in Colorado.
Confidence in the state's economy remains strong. Colorado's unemployment rate held steady at 2.8% last month, and employment growth is up over this time last year.
Colorado, like a number of other states, is experiencing a teacher shortage, and it's hit rural schools especially hard. Some schools are using technology to fill the gaps. But as KUNC's Stephanie Daniel reports, some districts on the Eastern Plains have reached outside the box, way outside the box, in fact, to fill open positions.
The lush landscapes, turquoise waters, and pristine beaches of the Philippine Islands are far removed from the brown, rolling plains of eastern Colorado, which Charmaine Teodoro now calls home. She's a first-year math teacher at Julesburg Junior Senior High School.
Just tell me a little bit about this board right here, because it's beautiful.
Okay, thank you.
A large dark blue bulletin board in her classroom is filled with photos highlighting her life in Manila. She created the collage at the suggestion of a school administrator who thought it would help her students get to know her better.
This is our flag, so this is my country. It's like several islands.
Teodoro was hired last August after a longtime math teacher left and the school couldn't find a replacement.
It's very different. It's kind of difficult just to prepare five lessons in a day, because I used to do just one lesson plan per day, and that just repeats for every single class that I have for the day.
Our ability to attract and recruit high caliber teachers is one of the biggest struggles that we have.
John Enos is the principal and superintendent of the Julesburg School District.
We ended up with having no applicants and really having to get creative in that realm and start to look overseas.
To teach in the U.S., foreigners need to have a visa and pass a background check.
Anecdotally, there have been more and more international candidates from, you know, outside the United States applying for licensure.
Tanya Klein is the director of licensure at the Colorado Department of Education. The length of a license is 1 to 5 years, depending on the needs and training of the educator.
Like, are they part of an exchange program? Are they coming over here with, you know, their spouse or their family? But as long as they can meet the requirements, we will issue the credential.
The state doesn't track the number of international educators here who come from all over the world. But according to 2016 federal data, 2,600 J-1 visas were issued to foreigners nationwide. Here in Colorado, there were 54, including Christine Malieri.
Finish your exploratory math. Angel, are you done?
About 30 miles south of Julesburg, Malieri is finishing up a 7th grade math class at Holyoke Junior Senior High School. She's been here for 4 years.
Before I came here, I already had 7 years of experience back home. And so the monthly salary there is like $500 a month.
Malieri is also from Manila. And now she makes an average of $3,200 a month.
I couldn't sustain my family's lifestyle, so I decided to come here for greener pastures. So I get to do what I love to do and at the same time earn well.
She said the first year was hard and overwhelming. But after a couple of months, she brought over her husband and daughter. And she's taken another new Filipino teacher in her school under her wing.
So is it nice to have someone else from your country?
True, it is really nice. You know, just because of the culture and how much similar you are and your struggles being, a foreign teacher at that. So it was really nice that you get to share your personal experiences with someone that you can really relate to.
Malieri and her family like it here so much, she plans to apply for a green card after her visa expires next year. She wants to stay in Holyoke.
We have filled high school special ed, physical science, biological science, and 4th grade teacher.
Tom Satterly is superintendent of schools in Burlington, which is along I-70 near the Kansas border. He says the Filipino teachers he's hired have been great, and the community has been welcoming. But he still tries to hire within the state first.
We are a small Eastern Plains town and community, and I love hiring people from small rural America because they understand what it's like.
Back in Julesburg, Charmaine Teodoro says life in a small rural town without all the amenities of a big city took some getting used to.
I want to go to the mall, but it's too far. But in the Philippines, it's just 30 minutes away by public transportation. It's different too.
International educators are a great way for schools to staff up. But with short-term visas and licenses, this is not a permanent solution. In our next story, we'll talk to teachers who already work in rural schools and hear what they think about the teacher shortage.
That was Stephanie Daniel. You can find this story and our look at how technology is helping with the teacher shortage at KUNC.org. Don't go anywhere. We've got lots more to get to in this episode, including a review of the new film Nancy from Howie Moshevitz. But before we get to that,
the 4th of July has come and gone, and with it, you were likely subjected to a few painful renditions of the Star Spangled Banner.
Yes, my Aunt Leslie, what can I say? She tries.
We all try. For some, including us and your Aunt Leslie, Francis Scott Key's iconic notes can be a little sour, if not downright impossible to hit. KUNC's Stacy Nick explains.
It doesn't seem to matter who you are.
Say, can you see by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming,
whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight. So gallantly streaming.
And the rockets red flag.
That's country artist Dierks Bentley, teenage one-hit wonder Kat DeLuna, Black Eyed Peas frontwoman Fergie, and former Olympic track star Carl Lewis. All were publicly lambasted for botching the national anthem.
I cringe because they bring out somebody that is messing around with it. Occasionally, you'll get an opera star to sing it.
But Dr. Ed Siegel doesn't think they deserve all the blame.
It's very low and then it's very high.
For more than 20 years, Siegel, a psychiatrist by trade and musician by hobby, has campaigned to make the anthem easier to sing.
Land of the free! Most people would drop down there. And the home of the brave! Ooh, that's not easy to sing.
With some minor tweaks, he says the song could be much easier, something he discovered almost by accident.
I have been conducting a sing-along for 31 years in Solana Beach, California, and I'm able to adjust the key to any song so that everyone can sing it. And so, without even thinking, I found that the key that I was playing it in allowed everybody to hit the high notes.
Typically, the anthem is performed in B-flat major. Siegel likes to perform it in G major.
Big difference, right?
This gave Siegel an idea. Why doesn't everyone just sing it in that key? And so began the campaign. It started small. He brought a resolution to the Solana Beach City Council asking that when the anthem was performed at city events, it be played in G major.
They unanimously accepted.
The movement gained a lot of media attention. But since then, he's been unable to convince people on a national level to make the change. Although, he's still holding out hope.
Because I saw that President Trump wasn't able to sing it. I'm hoping that he will find it, you know, something that even he can sing.
Now Siegel has enlisted the aid of his hometown orchestra, the Fort Collins Symphony, and local composer Ethan Boxley.
I really thought, well, here's my chance to sort of harmonize this timeless patriotic classic in a way that can really stir people's emotions.
Boxley, who is studying music composition at Northwestern University, wrote Fanfare for the National Anthem. The music features the anthem in a lower key.
I don't know. Sometimes in composing, it feels like you're trying to communicate the flood of emotion from that you feel so that other people will hear your music and feel that too.
If the anthem were just a little easier to sing, Ed Siegel believes more people would in fact sing, and not just this one song.
I think our country has developed like a PTSD about singing, because growing up here in Fort Collins, we sang all the time. We sang at the theaters, following the bouncing ball. We sang around the campfires at City Park. Everyone sang. Everyone. All these things have gone by the way. And when I ask people to sing, you'd think I was asking them to take their clothes off or something.
And he says, when you sing songs that inspire pride and patriotism, like the Star Spangled Banner, it encourages a sense of community and belonging. Even if we can't all sing like Beyonce. For KONC, I'm Stacey Nick.
Ethan Boxley's song was premiered at the City of Fort Collins 4th of July festivities.
Maybe with the festivities, you had a few beers to go along with your bad anthem singing.
I find the two usually go hand in hand.
That's true. Were your beers local Colorado beers, though? We do have some of the best craft beer, and we're not the only people who love it. So does the rest of the country.
Yeah, five northern Colorado breweries have been named among the best in the country. New Belgium and Odell Brewing in Fort Collins tied for 12th in the American Home Brewers Association annual poll. Also making the top 25, Longmont's Oscar Blues, Weld Works in Greeley, and Boulder's Avery Brewing Company.
According to the Colorado Brewers Guild, about 200 new breweries have opened statewide over the past 5 years.
Wow.
And in 2016, the industry had an economic impact of $3 billion.
With a B, and I know I've contributed my share of that.
Yeah, likewise.
Fear
can be a powerful motivator.
It motivates me to do a lot of things, like the laundry and vacuuming and dishes.
Those are chores. How are those things scary?
I fear divorce.
Oh, well, that makes sense when you put it like that. Well, there's one scenario along the Colorado River that is truly scary to those who are negotiating its future policies. It's called the Compact Call. And as KUNC's Luke Runyon reports, imagining what it could look like is giving some Western water managers nightmares.
To talk about the Colorado River's present and future, you need to start in the past, specifically 1922. That's when leaders from the seven western states that rely on the river met at a Santa Fe resort to sign an agreement, the Colorado River Compact.
It's the cornerstone of how we allocate water on the Colorado River.
Andy Mueller is general manager of the Colorado River District, a water management agency in western Colorado.
On that cornerstone is built an incredible scaffolding of complex agreements, but it's all based in that 1922 compact.
It divided the river into the upper and lower basins. The upper includes states like Colorado and Wyoming. The lower is more desert-like, with Arizona, Nevada, and California. Even then, Mueller says there were concerns that California could end up owning every last drop of the river.
The reality is that the lower basin had the upper hand in those negotiations. They were developing faster.
So to get to a deal, the snowier states agreed that they were on the hook to deliver a certain amount of water to lower basin states. It was their job to make sure California, Arizona, and Nevada always got their share of the river's water. Now, this works fine when there's enough water to go around, and it all looked pretty good on paper, but...
There were hydrologists working for the Bureau of Reclamation who were like the canaries in the coal mine, even back then, saying, we don't have enough water.
Today, water levels in the system's biggest reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, are dropping. Climate change is sapping the river's flow, and it's becoming easier and easier to imagine the lower basin making the dreaded compact call when those states say, give us our water.
It's never happened, and we don't want to see it happen because the chaos would cause economic uncertainty throughout the state.
Until now, this has just been an interesting thought experiment. How would this message get relayed? It could be a phone call.
It's California, Nevada, and Arizona on the line. They want their water.
Or maybe a text message.
Oh my God, look what I just got from California. They won't stop asking for their water.
Well, since we haven't ever had it, it's kind of hard to know.
Ann Castle is a senior fellow at the University of Colorado Boulder. She served in the Interior Department under President Obama.
I think it would probably take the form of a formal demand.
Okay, so it's more likely to be a boring letter, but it would set off a cascade of effects throughout the upper basin. States would have to rein in their own water use in order to meet their downstream obligations.
The state would likely start shutting down water rights from the most junior to as far as they had to go.
Those junior rights are often owned by cities, and a call would leave them scrambling to find more water supplies, so faucets in Denver, Albuquerque, and Salt Lake City didn't run dry.
We have to be ready. We don't want to make decisions about how we're going to handle a compact call should one occur when it's right there in front of us.
I was surprised to hear the Upper Basin express their concerns and fears when it's not something we've even really thought much about in the lower basin.
Jeff Keitlinger is in charge of the water agency serving the greater Los Angeles area. His agency, along with farmers in Southern California, would be the ones who would have to push for a compact call. And right now, he says they have way bigger fish to fry.
We're more focused on elevations in Lake Mead and what shortage conditions look like in the lower basin.
But he understands the upper basin's fears. And that's why Keitlinger says the focus now is on reining in water use throughout the basin to make sure a compact call never happens. I'm Luke Runyon.
The new film, Nancy, is by first-time feature filmmaker Grace Cho. It's about a young woman looking for attachment. Howie Mofshevitz, KUNC film critic who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says it's a movie of striking performances.
First-time feature director Grace Cho's Nancy feels like it's on downers. Most of the picture crawls through dark interiors. Outside, the light is flat and lifeless, and there's either an argument or a hunting accident. A harshly lit dinner scene and a brief encounter in a supermarket don't make the movie any cheerier. Nancy, Andrea Riseborough, is a sad sack stuck in her life. She has a conflicted relationship with her hectoring, palsied mother, whom she cares for, resents, and then snuggles up to for some hint of comfort. She has a temp job at a dentist's office in a failing strip mall. She tells coworkers that she's just back from a vacation in North Korea and has some photos that may or may not be genuine, and a story about how easy it was to be a tourist there that seems unlikely. She corresponds sympathetically, but under a false name, with a man, John Leguizamo, who's lost a child. She also pretends to be pregnant. Nancy yearns for a life and an identity. She believes she was adopted, but when she looks in her mother's birth certificate file, she finds an empty folder. Then a story appears on local television news about a couple who lost an infant daughter 30 years earlier. They still hope for clues to the daughter's disappearance, and they've set up a foundation. The story runs with a photo of the little girl alongside a picture of how she might look now. Nancy thinks she could be that missing kid. Director-writer Grace Cho and cinematographer Zoe White keep the camera close on faces that all look dead in the eyes. The mother of the kidnapped daughter, Anne Dowd, who played the horrifying Aunt Lydia in the recent version of The Handmaid's Tale, has great hopes that Nancy is that child now grown, but the defeat in her eyes shows how hard it is for her to believe anything can come of their meeting. The father, an unusually restrained Steve Buscemi, has little to say. Nancy's a film with plenty of uncomfortable silences. When characters talk, it's with effort. Speech comes in low voices. Characters hesitate because they don't know what to say. The close-ups keep you almost inside these stricken people. The film embodies their terrible loneliness, along with their simultaneous hope that Nancy is the missing daughter, and the fear that she's not, which will only amplify their misery. The difficulty for all of them is enormous. However it turns out, though, it's clear that Nancy's not a fraud. She just has no idea who she is, and she wants connection. What lifts the film above the heap of grim, low-budget, independent American movies that should never have been made is Andrea Riseborough. Buscemi, Dowd, and Leguizamo provide the support, but Riseborough's magnetic, even as her character shows almost no affect. Nancy's a movie of unremitting sadness, a sustained note that could drive an audience right up the wall, but you don't want to turn away from this actress. She looks like a waif. When she dyes her hair blacker, combs her listless bangs, and puts on makeup to go to the diner, it's just pathetic and hardly changes her looks at all. On a second meeting, Leguizamo says she looks different, and Nancy's comment that she's not wearing makeup would be a joke in a film with less emotional weight. Nancy's expression barely changes, except for slight intonations in her eyes, and hints that Nancy is completely conflicted and unrooted. She puts a photo of half of her face against half of the missing girl's hypothetical photo and believes they match, which I think is not so obvious to viewers. But you can't dodge the power of her need. Your heart goes to all three of these people, wallowing in their own prisons, taking tentative steps to relieve their pain, with little indication that they will ever get there. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me, Ashley Jeffcoat.
And me, Erin O'Toole. Ashley also manages digital. Editor Brian Larson contributed to our show.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana. Other music in this episode was Deluge by Cellophane Sam, Pives and Flarinet from Poddington Bear, Broke for Free with Warm Up Suit.
We also heard Jingle by Mon Plaisir, Reunion by Jazzar, plus the U.S. Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps performing the Star Spangled Banner. It was nice.
It was.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories.
You can subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.